Hello and welcome to Hindsight. I'm Sharon Davis, and today we're taking a chilly visit to the Antarctic. Captain Robert Falcon Scott. The name conjures up the image of an English hero walking to his death in the Antarctic, having reached the South Pole just a month after the famed Norwegian Roald Amundsen. The public focus on the death of Scott and his polar party in 1912, during one of the worst Antarctic winters on record, overshadowed an equally remarkable story from the same expedition, the amazing survival of Scott's northern party. The story of these six men during that same winter is one of the greatest endurance feats in Antarctic history, yet largely unknown. The group spent an unplanned winter in an ice cave on Inaccessible Island, and after that had to trek 250 miles back to Scott's base. As a small boy, Tony Fleming's mother, Jocelyn Priestley, often spoke of this heroic northern party. His grandfather was Raymond Priestley, the youngest member of the party. This year, on the centenary of the expedition, Tony became the first member of the Priestley family to revisit Antarctica.
My grandfather, Raymond Priestley, was 24 years old when he got the call from Captain Scott to join his ship, the Terra Nova, in 1910. Captain Scott's polar party was to make an attempt for the South Pole, while the Northern Party, under the leadership of Lieutenant Campbell, was to undertake scientific investigations and mapping. Grandad was a geologist and one of six members of the Northern Party. During the horrendous winter of 1912, unprecedented in Antarctic history, the group found themselves stranded and fighting for their lives on a precarious snowdrift on what they named Inaccessible Island. My mother's stories about Grandad had me in awe as a child. I always wondered what it would really have been like. So on the centenary of Scott's ill-fated expedition, I joined a more predictable one. The ship, the Spirit of Enderby, carrying guests and descendants of Captain Scott's men, was to follow the route taken by the Terra Nova in 1911. The journey took us from New Zealand to Antarctica's Ross Sea, retracing the Terra Nova's journey, and in particular for me, my grandfather's story.
It is the adventures of the Northern Party with which this journal is chiefly concerned, and this will therefore be a fitting place to introduce my companions and myself. Commander Campbell, Surgeon Levick, Officers Abbott and Browning, Seaman Dickerson, and myself, Raymond Priestley. On January 20th, 1911, we said goodbye to the polar party. And on the 27th, the Terra Nova left McMurdo Sound on her cruise to find us a home.
It's 2:30 in the morning and I'm getting my first views of the Antarctic mainland, and it is amazing. We're travelling into Cape Adare in Robinson Bay. This is where Grandad spent his first winter of 1911. We've got Adélie penguins porpoising around us, a lot of free water but a lot of ice as well, and the Admiralty Mountains ranging off in the distance. It is just the most magnificent view, and it must have been a sensation when Campbell found this place to land, and as a geologist, Grandad must have been beside himself. This is just such a spectacular place. I just can't find words to describe it. It's beautiful.
March 1911. Cape Adare on the Antarctic mainland. Longitude 172 degrees, latitude 70. Geological surveying and sledging excursions. Duration of stay, 10 months.
The weather was perfect for landing. We were certainly about to settle in one of the most beautiful spots in East Antarctica. Immediately at the back of the beach, Cape Adare rose steeply to a height of 4,000 feet, while the black and red of the basalt, of which it is composed, contrasted sharply with the white of the snowdrift. A nearly full moon, far brighter than an English harvest moon, threw a golden track over the unruffled surface of the water to the north of us, and the mountains to the south were just tipped by the rays of the rising sun.
We're now slowly steaming by a lot of floating ice, and much of that ice has Adélie penguins on it. It's an amazing thing, but this voyage now starts to make sense to me. When I was travelling in the Southern Ocean, even visiting the sub-Antarctic islands, I just couldn't envisage what it was like to be here. And it's not just the landscape, it's not just the beauty of the place. It's also this thing about reconnecting with my grandfather. I didn't know him very well. And this just makes it, that connection, more real. This is a place which meant a lot to him and a lot to my mother, and she would have loved to have been here. She is in Antarctica. Her ashes were scattered around in the Australian Antarctic Territory. It's a crazy thing, but this just brings back all those memories. Anyway, I've got to get ready to land and enjoy this wonderful place and meet a million Adélie penguins. Somewhere over there, there's this huge colony of Adélie penguins. And while it's very quiet up here at the top of the ship, once I get there, I probably won't have a thought to myself.
It was finally decided that we should adapt Borchgrevink's old winter quarters at Cape Adare to use, and our stores were accordingly landed there. From the foreshore rose the unmistakable sounds of a rookery of Adélie penguins.
I've just landed at Cape Adare, and I've now walked up to the site of the Northern Party's hut. There's not much of it remains. There's timber fallen on the ground, one wall, and there's a porchway which still stands. Next to it are the Borchgrevink's huts, the Southern Cross expedition. We're surrounded by a million Adélie penguins, and it's just an awesome sight.
Everywhere were signs that the place teemed with the types of life we were accustomed to look for in the Antarctic. Inquisitive skuas and giant petrels flew around us. An occasional snowy petrel darted gracefully by.
The first thing that I noticed when we were in the Zodiacs coming to shore is how small a promontory of land it is. It's surrounded by cliffs and ocean.
A magnificent swell beat on the northern shore of the beach, hurling large boulders of ice many yards up the sloping shores. That, and the sea, which broke on the southern edge of the beach during the blizzards, marked the period of the decline of the sun. It formed an ice foot of intricate formation, which was in itself a perfect gallery of beauty. After the middle of November, the bay ice itself was unfit for sledge travelling, and we were confined to Cape Adare itself. We spent most of our time photographing and studying the habits of the penguins. On January 4, the ship was sighted from our observation camp, and 2 days later, in spite of some trouble with the pack, we were all on board and steamed away south. Pack again prevented the ship landing us where we wished to go, and we were obliged to disembark in Terra Nova Bay, a little north of Inexpressible Island.
January the 8th. 1912. Glaciology and specimen collecting. Terra Nova Bay. Anticipated stay, 6 weeks.
Campbell had arranged with Pennell that the ship should call for us as soon after February 18th as possible, and that if she did not appear by March 5th, we were to resign ourselves to spend another winter here as best we might. And in the very unlikely event of the ship not reaching Terra Nova Bay before she was obliged to return to New Zealand, we should have to exist on what seals and penguins we could catch before the winter set in. At the time, however, we would all have sworn that if there was one place along the coast which would be accessible in February, this would be the one. During the following weeks, an almost continuous cold plateau gale swept across the Piedmont. At the end of the month, our sledging provisions were due to come to an end.
It became obvious to them that they were in trouble. Despite the fact that they could see clear water offshore, there was no ship. In fact, the ship tried 3 times to reach them and very nearly got stuck in pack ice on the 3rd attempt. And then the ship's captain, Pennell, knew that he had to head back to New Zealand and leave the Northern Party to their fate.
The chief trouble during the out-of-door work was the wind. Once it had upset you, the load you were carrying, joints of meat, penguins, or 100 weight or so of blubber, successfully held you down until you had recovered your breath and lost your temper. Usually, one's temper remained lost even when one's balance was recovered. We moved over to the shores of Inexpressible Island. Here was situated a snowdrift, out of which we proposed to build our future home. While the attention of half the party was directed towards stocking our food depots, the other three were engaged in tunnelling into the only snowdrift of any size on the island.
Inexpressible Island, 164 degrees east, 75 degrees south. Food rationing begins March 1912. Duration of stay, 7 months.
As we're sailing down through Terra Nova Bay, an inexpressible island is about to come into sight. It will be a wonderful experience to be at that landscape, at that point in Antarctica where those stories originate from.
Well, welcome to Inexpressible Island. I don't know whether people have worked out what we've got is an island surrounded by glaciers on both sides. So all we can really see is the eastern side of the island. So we're just looking at the eastern side, the northern, western and southern coasts completely surrounded by glaciers. So that's a big glacier, the Priestley coming down there.
This continuous cold gale has to be experienced before its merciless power can be realized. And as I describe the next few months, they will, I fear, lose much of their significance by my failure to conjure up the atmosphere of infernal, never-ending, frostbiting wind.
The site came to be known as Inexpressible Island, and I think that speaks volumes for their winter. This island is raked by katabatic winds throughout the winter. Grandad records barely 24 hours of calm for 8 months.
The barometer isn't much use to us nowadays.
Katabatic winds average a speed of about a force 8 gale.
If it goes up, it means the gale is going to be stronger.
That's just the average.
If it goes down, the wind is going to increase.
And there are sustained gusts and sustained periods where it's at hurricane strength.
Cheerful, isn't it?
So God alone knows how they survived the winter here.
In the middle of the glaciers coming down on the north side and on the south side of it. Inexpressible, and Tony's told you why it's inexpressible. It's going to be inexpressibly cold this morning. It's going to be inexpressibly cold. But the reason we're going to have a go now is that it is doable, and this evening it might not be doable. So we'll take the opportunity while we've got it. There's no danger involved. The Zodiacs are quite safe, but they will be a little splashy with the wind that's there. And so I do ask that you dress very warmly.
It's going to be a wonderful thing to be able to see the location, to get a sense of the landscape that Grandad endured that winter in. Fortunately, we're seeing it on a good day. There's blue sky, it's a beautiful landscape, and I'm hopeful that there won't be too many winds.
Okay, the plan is we're going to drop the anchor here. We'll be using the starboard tide gangway. I'm going to put a couple of boats in the water. And because of the winds coming out of this quarter here, we hope to get a little bit of lee on this corner just in here for a landing. You can walk along. There, it's quite rocky underfoot. It's quite rocky. There's boulders, granite boulders there. And the igloo, or the site of the northern party, it's up the hillside. You can't walk on the flat, you've got to boulder hop across. You will be boulder hopping, it's just not walking on flat ground all the time, you're just having to walk across the boulders.
The I'm sitting on the site of the Northern Party's ice cave, basically sitting where it was, and I'm just staggered at the harshness of this environment and how on earth did they survive a winter here. I didn't have a lot of equipment to build the ice cave, and in fact they had to use Granddad's picks and geological picks that he used for exploration. But somehow they were able to hack out a cave 8 foot by 12 foot, maximum height about 5 foot 6 inches.
The living room was lined halfway up its height on all sides, except immediately opposite the fireplace, with snow blocks cut out of the softer portion of the drift, and about 12 by 9 by 30 inches in size.
And there they resided for about 7 or 8 months.
In one corner of the hut, a shallow trench a yard square was dug, and this was paved with 8 large flattish boulders and was used as a fireplace.
The sun doesn't rise in the winter here, and the only light they had was a blubber lamp, which is about 1 candle power in strength. And the blubber stove, which they used to cook food, didn't burn cleanly, and so the cave very quickly developed this black, sooty interior. They called it smitch.
Then ventilation became a farce. Both chimney and shaft were blocked up, and on 2 occasions at least, we were as near asphyxiation as I ever care to be. The term smoke did not seem adequate to express the oily brown fumes which rose from the blubber stoves. But Browning provided us with a sufficiently expressive word from his West Country vocabulary, and the terms smitch and smitch blindness had by now become a regular part of our vocabulary.
The story of Scott's Northern Party and the part that Grandad played in its survival have become key stories in our family.
For the next 6 months, our daily ration consisted of between 1 and 2 biscuits per day, 8 lumps of sugar every Sunday.
In some ways, I ended up getting sick of Grandad's story because whenever I complained about anything, Mum said, "Oh, what your Grandad had to endure."
1.5 ounces of chocolate every Saturday.
3 teaspoons of tea every Sunday.
Butchering meat in temperatures below zero.
Our hands were often numb.
We were all suffering very much.
Is it a 2 biscuit or a 1 biscuit morning?
And I always got reminded of that Monty Python skit, The 4 Yorkshiremen.
And the leaves reboiled on Monday. Every Saturday evening we held a sing-song. On Sunday, we managed to rake together at least 12 hymns and a couple of psalms. And Campbell read us a chapter of the New Testament, of which we had a pocket edition. The other 3 books we possessed, David Copperfield, Simon the Jester, and Balfour's Life of Stevenson, were successfully read.
The Northern Party was digging its ice cave and then settling in. Way down south, Scott and his party were nearing their end. It's probably good that he didn't know, because their morale was fragile at that stage. It strengthened during the winter, surprisingly enough. But it would have shattered them all to know the fate of the Polar Party.
On August 10th, according to Campbell's calculations, the sun was due to return. We caught sight of it for a few minutes on the 13th. Towards the end of September, we decided to start down the coast in an attempt to reach Cape Evans.
September the 30th, 1912. The sledge journey to Cape Evans begins. 250 miles south. Arrive at Cape Evans, 5th of November, 1912.
On October 10, we sighted Mount Erebus. We had only to glance to the southward and see this most historic Antarctic mountain to feel that the hard work was not in vain, but that we were really approaching comfort once more.
And one of the most amazing things about it is that at the end of all of this, they then had to self-rescue, pull sledges 250 miles across the Drygalski ice barrier, down the coast, across unknown land to them, to find safety at Cape Evans. It's such a strong family story that it's an amazing thing to be here, to just stand in Granddad's footsteps for just a few minutes to see what he saw and to feel what he felt. I didn't know Granddad very well, but the story has been retold in the family. It was very, very important to my mum, and she made sure all us kids understood it.
The rest of the journey resolved itself into a depot crawl for the remaining 70 miles. Six men, very tired and worn out, and fit for nothing much but a good rest.
Remarkable leadership, remarkable resourcefulness, but to actually then, at the end of winter, walk to Cape Evans was remarkable. The whole feat was overshadowed by Scott's death and
It's a remarkable journey, that, and like I say, overshadowed by Scott's death. If Scott hadn't died, I think, and had been second to the pole, this story would have been the story that that was probably taught in the schools or read in the schools, you know, but now it's sort of, it's below the radar a wee bit, sadly. But it's a story that's never really been fully appreciated, I think. So to come here and to actually sit amongst the rocks and to... It's overwhelming, I think. It's just to see the conditions into which the Northern Party lived here, to see the bones of the seals, the dead penguins, and just to try and picture in their mind what it would have been like to spend that winter here.
Many at Cape Evans Hut had given up the Northern Party for dead. And there was great celebration when they finally walked in the door. But just a few days after that, the recovery team, which had gone south to find out what had happened to Scott and the Polar Party, came back and retold their grisly discovery. So there were very mixed emotions for many, and for Grandad in particular.
This ends the history of the Northern Party as a separate unit. It will be recognised by all of you that it is not really my place to set this story before you, but Commander Campbell was unable to do so. This does, however, give me the opportunity to place on record the debt that we of the Northern Party owe to him for his unfailing cheerfulness and fertility of resource, which went far towards bringing the party through a winter which is almost without parallel in the history of Antarctic exploration.
The Heritage Conservation Team, which have been working on the Discovery Hut, have packed their supplies in the chopper, and they're about to head off to McMurdo Base to catch a flight back to New Zealand. They've done a fantastic job in the hut, and thanks to them, the hut will last another 100 years. Choppers are the modern sled of the Antarctic. I'm sure those explorers 100 years ago would love to have had that sort of transport available to them. There goes the Eurocopter. Very comfortable inside. They got a spectacular view, and they're safe.
Come, Eastern party breaker, out and sing your sledging song. Come, tauten out that thong and heave the load along. Lean forward in your traces and step out straight and strong. Be the weather what it may, we'll make our miles today. This depot we must lay, be the surface right or wrong. For we've got Canada.
The main lesson my grandfather took away from his ordeal was with how little a man can not only keep alive, but be reasonably happy and content. Having now glimpsed the conditions he endured, I'm in awe of his positive outlook. But even more important was the scientific legacy of the expedition. With remarkable accuracy, they mapped significant parts of the Antarctic continent, and their recordings of meteorological and geological data are still being used today. Their discovery of fossils also provided clear evidence of a different climate in Antarctica's past. But perhaps most importantly of all, Scott's Terra Nova expedition created the idea that the pursuit of scientific knowledge should be at the centre of Antarctica's future.
Got lockers in their cabins and the mates and bowls and squared. Birdie will see us through, anxiety we spared. And Nelson Thor will play the game, he'll part up like a lamb. Though he'll call us raving, thieving sons of Ham. Oh, damn.
Inexpressible Island was recorded and narrated on location by Tony Fleming. The Young Raymond Priestley's Journal was read by Michael Wally. Thanks also to Rodney Russ and the crew of the Spirit of Enderby. The sound engineer was Judy Rapley and the producer, Ros Blewett. And since Tony Fleming returned from the trip, he's been appointed to the post of Director of the Australian Antarctic Division. The memory of his grandfather's connection to Antarctica is no doubt an inspiration. And to see some terrific photos of Tony's journey south, including a penguin getting stuck into some of the ABC's microphones, go to our website at abc.net.au/rn/hindsight. And now another survival story that also dipped well below the radar at the time. And it was only 3 years after the survivors of Scott's group left Cape Evans. This is a story of the Ross Sea Group, who were part of Ernest Shackleton's 1914 expedition. Michelle Rayner found this fascinating account of the group's ordeal in the ABC archives. Surviving member Dick Richards recounts the story.
It was, in a sense, the most satisfying period in my life. You've got to clothe yourself, you've got to feed yourself, you've got to get the water to drink, and you've got to do all those things. That is when life really is satisfying.
Dick Richards, who spent 2 years surviving in the icy white Antarctic landscape as part of the 1914 expedition of Sir Ernest Shackleton, who in his third visit to the south intended to traverse the continent from South America to the New Zealand side. Dick Richards was part of a team of 10 men who were given the task of laying a series of food depots for Shackleton, from McMurdo Sound in the Ross Sea to Mount Hope, nearly 500 kilometres away. The men took up residence in an old hut on Ross Island, which had been built by the explorer Scott in 1910. From this base, Dick Richards' group began their task of organising supply drops for Shackleton's team, which involved sledging across the ice and leaving the supplies at various points along Shackleton's planned route. But Shackleton's own sea voyage would never reach its destination. His ship, the Endurance, was beset by ice and finally sank, leaving the men stranded in icy waters and eventually tossing them up on Elephant Island. While the story of Shackleton's leadership and survival is now quite rightly famous, the experience of Dick Richards' supply party is perhaps less well known. In May 1915, around the same time that Shackleton and his men were drifting in ice, the supply party themselves were hit by disaster when their ship, the Aurora, broke away from its moorings and drifted out to sea, leaving the 10 men stranded at Cape Evans. For the next 2 years, while the rest of the world was thrust into the Great War, the party lived in Scott's old hut, staving off illness and fear and wondering of their fate. And because they had no knowledge of Shackleton's circumstances, they assumed that their job, to leave supplies for the land expedition, was still a necessary one. 3 men perished in Dick Richards' party during their years in Antarctica, and finally, in January 1917, the remaining 7 were rescued by Ernest Shackleton himself, who sailed into Cape Evans on the abandoned Aurora. Before his death in 1985, Dick Richards recorded this interview and recalled the events in May 1915 which led to those 2 long cold years in Antarctica.
It was my duty to get up and take the various instrumental readings at 3 in the morning. It was a moonlight night. There was a moderate wind blowing and snow drifts up to a height of about 50 feet. Not by any means a severe weather. And as I left the door of the hut, I automatically looked seaward, where the Aurora should have been seen, or at least the top parts of her mast should have been seen. And to my amazement, there was no sign of the mast. So I walked down to the water's edge and found that all the ice had gone out and that these steel horses, which we thought were so very secure, were kinked on the edge of the ground. Well, we didn't see the Aurora anymore. In fact, we thought that she'd been lost. In the meantime, of course, we were completely isolated from all communication with the outside world. In fact, from the time the Aurora left Australia at the end of 1914 until we saw the Aurora in 1917, we had no communication whatever with the outside world, nor they with us. We didn't know what was going on during those momentous years of the First World War, for instance. We talked it over and we thought there was every chance of a ship coming back in the next day or so. But after a couple of days, we got the worst blizzard that we'd had up to that time, with a wind with gusts that were well over 100 miles an hour, and this lasted for 3 days. So after that, with no sign of the ship, we came to the conclusion that there was every possibility that she was not afloat. So we made an inventory of what was there in the way of stores. And then, of course, all our efforts were devoted to preparing for the sledging, because we felt that above all things, no matter how we were marooned or what circumstances we were in, we simply had to lay the depots that we were there for. We were in Scott's hut at Cape Evans. Unfortunately, the ship had not put any of our supplies ashore. No clothing, no food, no sledging equipment. And the 10 of us who were there at that time found ourselves rather hard put to it to make do. As far as clothing was concerned, we used quite a lot of second-hand clothing that Scott's party had left behind. And indeed, we cut up a very large green canvas tent for windproof blouses and trousers, cut up some old fur sleeping bags for fur boots and various expedients of that sort. Scott himself had left a great deal of provisions, so that so far as ordinary provisions were concerned, flour and that sort of thing, we were quite well enough supplied, but we had no fuel whatever. And for fresh meat, and particularly fuel, we had to draw on the seal population. And that meant that we had to kill somewhere about 500 seals a year and use them mainly for blubber, for cooking and for heating purposes. The seals down in the south, they have no fear of man, probably because they've had no enemies above the water, and one can approach them without any trouble. They don't even look at you. And to kill them, we used to stun them and then cut their throats and take the blubber off in long strips, lay it on the ice to freeze, and then load it into the sledges and take it in like timber into the hut. With regard to living in the hut at Cape Evans, the food that was found there from Captain Scott and the fresh meat that we obtained from the seals was quite adequate. But the techniques of sledging in those days, which are rather different to at present, involved leaving all source of fresh food and sledging into the interior of the ice shelf. And the result of that is that after prolonged periods of heavy labour and complete absence of fresh food, that the parties begin to suffer from the deficiency disease known as scurvy. Now, from our own experience and from the experience of the other parties that had preceded us in the Antarctic from 1901 with Captain Scott right through to our own time, the timetable of the incidence of scurvy is pretty constant. And after 90 days of complete absence of fresh food, the first signs of scurvy appear. And that usually occurs in the gums. They become a bit spongy with black blisters on them. And then one is noticeably weaker. And in our case, it affected the legs. After 5 months, indeed, death may take place.
As well as scurvy, the Ross Sea Party also had to contend with snow blindness, a regular danger as they attempted to sledge across the ice and leave their supply drops for Shackleton. Dick Richards.
In the medicine chest, we had small, thin wafers, about an eighth of an inch in diameter and paper thick, of cocaine. And if the snow blindness was capable of being treated while you're in the tent, we'd make a solution of that and drop it into the eyes. But very often it was not possible. You were sledging, your tents were on the sledge, and you couldn't get at it. So in those cases, we used to drop these little thin tablets into the eye directly, and then bind the eyes with a cloth of some sort, and the chap who had it would get back and hang on to a rope and we pulled it and go along that way. But we were pretty careful most of the time to wear goggles. The only time when you couldn't do that was if the man happened to be in the lead at the head of the rope on the sledge, and it was his job to look out for any cracks or anything like that. And if you had what the Americans call a whiteout, when there's no difference between snow and sky, you know, which is up and down, well, then goggles are no good to you. You've got to just put them up and use your eyes and hope for the best. And 24 hours darkness from May till August. Even in the darkness, we had to go out and seal. And we couldn't wash for the whole of the period we were there for the simple reason that we had no soap. And most of the stuff that was on us was grease from the seals and the blubber, you see. And when we were rescued, of course, we were just simply black with this blubber and accumulated grime. He says we smelt to high heaven, but thank heavens not to each other. But we didn't shift our clothes for 10 months. When we came back from our sledging, for instance, very sick, their clothing in tatters and all that sort of thing, we didn't come back to a base where there were doctors. We had no doctor. We had no medicines. We came back and there was nobody there. There was a hut half full of ice. We had fierce arguments at times about everything under the sun. We used to refer to the Encyclopedia Britannica, but to settle the arguments, but the time came when they wouldn't even accept the authority of the Encyclopedia Britannica. I'll tell you the stupid sort of argument that you had, one that I can remember. The exact number of miles around the coastline of Australia. And they got quite heated about this. The relations were astonishingly good. And no psychological problems. I personally think we were too busy, because there were only seven of us there in the second year, you see. We'd lost three. And it took us all we knew to get food, get seals, get fuel, get water, make clothing, and then carry out a little bit of our own routine scientific work that was done. It was, in a sense, the most satisfying period in my life. What you were doing was directly associated with your own life. You're paid something to do your job, and you hold out your hand and you get paid, but it's an indirect way of keeping yourself alive. But if you've got to clothe yourself, you've got to feed yourself, you've got to get the water to drink, and you've got to do all those things, that is when life really is satisfying. Toward the end of 1916, I was rather seriously ill, and I was convalescent, and it was my practice to go out with glasses of a morning after breakfast and look around to see if there are any seals in sight. On this particular morning in January, I think it was January the 10th, 1917, I looked seaward as I came out of the door of the hut and saw in the distance something drifting to the south. I wasn't too certain what it was, because so often icebergs came in of all sorts of shapes and sizes and drifted south. And I slung the glasses, was just putting them up to my eyes to have a closer look at it, when evidently the stokers on board fired up and smoke came out of the funnel. As soon as the smoke appeared, I realised that some ship or other had come down to rescue us. So I turned around and went back into the hut and quite quietly remarked, "The ship's here." And they were just finishing breakfast, and they looked up and thought it was rather a bad joke and didn't do anything about it. So for a while there was no excitement at all, but once I persuaded them to get up and have a look out of a window and they saw that there really was a ship there, it was a different story. the ship couldn't come very close to the shore on account of the sea ice, and we had to sledge out over the sea ice to make this meeting. As we got closer to the ship, we noticed three black specks, they turned out to be men, coming over the ice towards us. And at the meeting, it was found that Shackleton was one of the three, and I think his first words were, "Joyce, I'm glad to see you." Joyce was one of his old men. And after the handshakes and greetings, inevitable on such an occasion, we were astounded to notice three of these men who'd come out to meet us lying down on the ice. That was a signal which they'd arranged with Captain Davis to tell him how many were lost. When we were rescued finally, there were seven of us left. We had been completely out of touch with the momentous events of World War I, but the ship had brought down a very good supply of illustrated journals showing what had been going on in the 2 years or so that we'd been away. We were completely stunned by the world into which we were coming back, because we left with the outlook of 1914 and came back with all the developments in warfare that had occurred over the intervening period. Unrestricted submarine, stories of atrocities, poison gas and all the rest of it. And this completely stunned us for quite a period.
The late Dick Richards, one of seven survivors of the Ross Sea Party, the group who was stranded in Antarctica during Ernest Shackleton's ill-fated 1914 expedition. And Dick Richards died in 1985. Thanks to Michelle Rayner and Judy Rapley.